Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park in Portland. Swing dance lessons start an evening of live music with breaks included for short informational speeches about the life and history of jazz in the early 20th century. Again, that's Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park between Northeast 11th Avenue and Holiday Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at In Other Words Bookstore in Portland. A panel of African women from different organizations will be highlighting the issues impacting African women across the globe and to highlight the necessity for African women to be united and organized on a worldwide basis against imperialism. Edutainment and childcare will be provided. Again, that's Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at 5:30 p.m. at In Other Words Bookstore, 14 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. Right now, it's Veterans Voice with Marvin and Angie. Their guest today is Iraq combat vet Michaela Montoya. And at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio. And at 11, hear a pilot program of a new show called A Radio Geekly. The weather will be sunny and hot today. Be sure and stay hydrated, and thank you for your generous support here at KBOO. And one more little thought, that if you're not a current member, you can easily become one when you go to kbu.fm and click on Donate. Thanks for doing that. And we go now to Veterans Voice.
Soldiers of peace and not fighting the war, are not looking for enemies behind every door, are not looking for people to kill or to maim. The soldiers of peace are just changing the game. Men who were fighting for all of our lives are now fighting for children, for homes and for wives, fighting for the memory of all who fell before. But the soldiers of peace just can't kill anymore. Can still hear the cries when the people were screaming, losing their lives, when bodies were broken and spirits were torn. But the soldiers of peace do not want you to mourn. So come on, you warriors who live for the fight.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland and the Pacific and Northwest Oregon, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Columbia River Gorge, plus 104.3 FM Corvallis and the Willamette Valley. You can hear the station on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. And if you want to hear some of our earlier shows, you can go to KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice and hear some of our older shows. I'm Marvin, and I'm here with Angie.
Good morning.
Our guest today is Michaela Montoya, and we're going to be speaking with her. But first, I got something that's for our veterans. The state of Oregon has launched the first Veterans Rental Assistance Program. And it's through Oregon Health Authority along with Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And it's designed to provide transitional housing for military veterans who have serious mental illness and are homeless or at the risk of being homeless. And it's a really good program. They have spots for 147 veterans. And that's in Clackamas, Marion, and Columbia, and Yamhill, and Jackson counties. So that's pretty good. And if folks need to get a hold of them, they can go to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs website. And if you don't have, can get on the web, you can give them a call. And there's the person at OHA, Oregon Health Authority, you can give her a call. Her name's Shelley, and her number is 503-947-5534. Or you can call ODVA, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and Mitchell Sparks, and that number is 503-373-2249. And if you're a veteran and you need help, if you're houseless, these folks can give you some help, get you going on that. And that's there's a lot of money out there that they're wasting on war that they could be putting to people, you know, into homes. And this month, on August 2nd and August 4th, the United States of America got drug into the Vietnam War at the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And I thought I'd bring that up because that was a big lie that got us into the war deeper than we were. Without that incident, 2 million Vietnamese would have not lost their lives, and over 58,000 American troops would have not lost their lives. And it was just a mess, and it turned out to be a big lie, and it turned out that they knew it was a lie, but they went ahead and did it anyway. So if you want to look that up, go and look up Gulf of Tonkin incident, T-O-N-K-I-N incident, and you'll be very angry about what they did. I think it would be really, you know, how many wars has this country got in through lies? You know, what drug us into these lies, these wars, you know? Well, we know the first Iraq war was a lie. You know, they drug us into that. That was a big lie. And what other wars were lies that they drug us in and we killed millions and millions
probably
of people.
All of them, including the drone strikes.
Yep. Oh boy, the drones are just horrible. And do you have anything?
I have a few things.
Okay, she's got some.
So one of the things that some veterans should know about is that recently the suicide hotline was revamped. It's called Option 7. So that means that instead of calling, you can call the 1-800 number 273-TALK still and press Option 1. That's still the same. But there were problems with veterans calling the actual VA hospital, and then they would get rerouted. Sometimes they would get to an answering machine of their mental health care provider, and then they would have to hang up and recall this phone number, and so it got, sometimes it's very frustrating, and in a time of crisis is not the best thing for veterans who are experiencing that. And so now all you have to do, whether you call the VA or the 1-800-273-TALK number, is press one phone number. So that really simplifies things. And just to put this in perspective for people, in Oregon, veterans account for 9% of the population, but 23% of the suicides.
Yeah.
So it's very disproportionate. And in Oregon, for veterans under the age of 45, that is the number one way of death is,
right,
is suicide. So if you're a veteran in Oregon and you're under 45, that's what the statistics say, which is pretty troubling. So, and something else is, for the technology people out there, there's actually an app that might help with PTSD that I read about. It uses what's called image rehearsal therapy, and it's meant for if you have a nightmare, you can start writing down what that nightmare is. And then the idea behind image rehearsal therapy is you take that nightmare and you rewrite it in a certain way that is less painful for you.
Wow.
Or you basically rewrite your own nightmare to experience either something positive in the end, or you just, out of writing it down over and over, it starts to lose its significance.
Right.
So that's a way to actually give less value to your nightmares, and then begin to build something more positive and less tragic. And also, VA doctors in some states are able to recommend medical marijuana now.
Wow!
So I just wanted to that was back in May that happened, but I don't know if people know about that. And
wow,
so that means that if you go to your VA hospital and you want to talk about medical marijuana with your doctor, you can do that.
Wow.
So, and that is very helpful, especially because we know how many medications veterans are on a lot of times. Opioids are very harsh on the body and addictive, and maybe this can be an alternative.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And very quickly, the last thing I wanted to say was they actually changed the name of No Child Left Behind Act. Okay, so Marvin laughs.
No Child Left Behind.
It's now called the Every Student Succeeds Act.
Oh, my.
That's what that's called. And for people who don't know about the No Child Left Behind Act, in Portland, military recruiters were out of the schools for about 8 years.
Yeah, we had them out for 8 years.
And the only way that they, well, not the only way, but the main way that they got back into the schools was because of the No Child Left Behind Act.
Exactly.
And what the No Child Left Behind Act mandated was that any public school that wanted to receive federal funds had to allow military recruiters in their schools, and the schools had to hand over the information of students in the school. So automatically, parents of kids in the Portland, not just Portland, but the school system in general, your children's information is going directly to the military recruiters.
Right.
So that's by default. If you do not want that to happen, then you have to fill out what's called an opt-out form. And so that is something for students to know, for parents to know, and you have to fill out that form if you don't want your kids' information to go to the military recruiters.
Yeah, you have to. We tried to go around that. We tried to have it changed to that you had to opt in, and
right.
You had to opt in, but they wrote the law, so it had to be opt out.
And the point I'm making here is that the Every Student Succeeds Act and the No Child Left Behind Act, you have to opt out for both of those things. Right. That has not changed.
Yeah,
so.
that definitely not changed. And the thing you were talking about with the suicides and veterans, something that just came out, there was another study that came out, and it was about the death rate of Korean War veterans and Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans, I think it was. And the World War II veterans are dying of old age. They're dying from being old age, and same way with the Korean veterans. But now it's starting to show up that Vietnam vets are dying at a younger age than the Korean or the World War II veterans had been dying with. That I think that came down that they broke it down that Vietnam veterans were dying by the age of 65.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Korean War veterans, it was something like 75. And I can't remember what the World War II veterans were, but that was kind of, since I'm going to be 68, you know, so far I've beat it, you know. But I've known a lot of my buddies have died. They died by the time they were 65. A lot of them have died by the time they were 65. So I think you want to go ahead and introduce our guest there?
Sure. Are you there, Michaela?
Yeah, I'm here. I had it on mute.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Good. Should we call you Mika on here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great, Mika.
So did you, could you tell people, first of all, I like to begin with when you joined the military and where you joined from and why?
Sure. Hi, everyone. So my name is Misayela Montoya Mika for short. I joined the military back in 2002. I was still in high school.
Wow.
And I decided to join. I was 17 years old. I was going into my senior year. And it wasn't something that I really planned on. I wasn't sure if I was ready for the military. I just knew that I needed sort of some foundation and security guidance. So I decided to kind of get my feet wet by joining the National Guard and then kind of deciding from there if I wanted to go active duty or not. So right after I graduated high school in June, I left to basic in July. And it was funny because another reason why I joined the National Guard was because I believed my recruiter when he said that the title of what you do, what you do is in the title of the National Guard. You guard the nation.
Wow.
As the rest of the military goes off to war.
Oh, wow.
Literally, yes. So he said the bases are empty, quote unquote, because, you know, they're off to war. I was worried about getting deployed since 9/11 had just happened like a year prior.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, someone needs to guard those bases, and that's what the National Guard does. So I learned that was wrong.
Whoa.
Yeah. So then about, when I got back from basic, I got my orders 6 months later to get deployed to Iraq for 545 days. So that was like total shocker for me.
So you basically were told that you're being deployed to Iraq very quickly, actually.
Yeah, it was real quick. It was literally 6 months after I got back from AIT. And I was 19 then, you know, and I left in September. So, you know, when you're National Guard or reservist, I don't know if reservist is the same way, but when you're National Guard, you kind of like, they mobilize you and they kind of like train you more like active duty style in at a base camp. So I was stationed at Fort Dix. And we were there for a while, and then they mobilize you to whatever country you're going to. So I was going to Iraq, and then came back.
How did you feel when you were told that you were going?
I was so shocked because, I mean, I honestly felt like, what if I didn't answer my phone? I never really thought about how people find out they're going to war. So when, you know, I was just 19, chilling on the couch and at my grandma's house, And I got a phone call, I answered it, and it was my, I think it was like my first sergeant. He was saying, you know, get ready, you're going to get ready to go, come and sign your orders or something like that. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that it was so simple, like a simple cell phone call to let me know I'm going to Iraq.
When did you go, and where did you go, and what did you do when you were there?
Yeah, what was your job?
So, yeah, with my recruiter, I told my recruiter back then, you know, I was a teenager, I wanted to do anything outside of computers. I didn't want to have anything to do with computers. So he gave me a job with, like, being an automated logistical specialist, which is a fancy name for a supply clerk, which is totally, you know, computers doing warehouse stuff. So when I went to Iraq, that's what they had me doing for about maybe like a month. And that from there, they tasked majority of us, it's admin positions, out to military police positions, like I guess what you would consider infantry positions, not me, but other people, because of the civilian contractors. So we had so many civilian contractors that were taking up our admin positions that they were tasking everyone out to do those positions. So then I became a guard on a checkpoint that was the main checkpoint. Like, it was the only way you could get on and off our base, night shift from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. for the rest of my tour.
What kinds of things did you experience, and how did the, did you, I'm sure you interacted with the Iraqi people a little. How was that?
Yeah, so we had like three positions, and we would rotate those positions. So every day we would carry, you know, we would be full Bauderado with our Kevlar, six magazines fully loaded, M16 at the ready. And from that, we would also man either an M, it would change up, but we would man either an M60, an M249, or we would be driving the tank or manning the 50 cal along with what we had. So it would just be a rotation of that every night. No days off, just every single night.
Wow. How did the Iraqi people react to you?
From what I got through, like, intel, is that there was two women. There was one during the day and one at night. Well, we had more at night, but we would kind of switch off. So there'd always be kind of like one woman on the post at the time, at least. But so what we got from intel is that they were trying to kidnap us.
What?
Because we were... Yeah, because we were so, like, accessible there, and, you know, they knew where we were all the time. So that was the intel that we got. And I know they would, like, kind of look at me, like, kind of strange, because they weren't really used to seeing, like, you know, our woman faces from the U.S. And I always wore mascara. It was just, like, my own little security thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that was kind of shocking in a way, too. But we had, like, really good translators that we worked with, like, every single day that were amazing. And that kind of, like, leads into later on what I'm doing now.
Did you believe in what you were doing at the time? Or were you just kind of going through the motions?
Yeah, everybody that was there, I feel like, was just going through the motions. Because, okay, so we were like an all-National Guard unit. So
from California, you know, right?
No, it's actually funny, because when a military unit is not at least 80% capacity to mobilize, then they have to make them at 80%. And instead of pulling people locally, for whatever reason, they pulled people from California. So it was attached to a Brooklyn unit in New York under 4th ID.
Huh.
So what were you saying in the question?
Screen.
Oh, so we were a lot more I think we were a lot more in tune with our civilian side, so we were just kind of going through the motions. We did our training through different ways, but one of them that kind of stuck out to me is that we did this virtual, like, training, and it was just like a huge wall, and that those were like our targets that we would aim at for training wise. So when I went, and I don't know about everybody else, so when I went, I was literally just kind of going through the motions. And unfortunately, I never really thought of the Iraqi people as Iraqi people when I first got out there. I just literally looked at them as the enemy.
Talk about that for a minute, because I think that's important to think about the dehumanization that happens when we're in an illegal occupation, which is still happening, by the way. What kinds of things, how did that happen? Why did you not really see them as full people?
I think the biggest thing, I mean, I've learned now is the use of terrorists. I mean, that's just so easily thrown around sometimes to individuals. And because they, you know, there wasn't, you know, there really isn't a specific look that a terrorist has other than, you know, how a typical, any Iraqi person would look. It was hard for us to, like, differentiate. So I would always just look at them like they were all just, I didn't look at them as human. And until one night we were on the convoy, I mean, I'm sorry, there was a convoy coming in. So every night, I mean, you know, out there you practice light control. It's completely pitch black. You can see for miles because of that. We would see IEDs go off often. You know, we would see the convoy go, you know, go by us, and we would see the IED go off, and they would keep going. But there was this one particular night. It was actually the night that I learned how to drive the tank. Like, I learned there on the spot. And, like, we seen the IED go off, and instead of them kind of keep it pushing, keep it going, they made a right, and they came on to, they were coming at us. So at that point, we didn't really know what to expect, so we were all, like, on high alert, we were ready to go. And then we found out that it was one of the Iraqi soldiers that was supporting us there that got hurt, that there was a few of them that were hurt. And I just remember seeing, and like I said, the whole time I never really looked at them as human. Like, I hate to say that, but it was the truth, and I think that was for everybody. But when I seen someone, like, this guy get off, he threw up. I asked my battle buddy that was there, and I was like, why is he throwing up? And he said his brother just died.
Oh,
and wow. when he said that, I just had, like, this flush of, like this warm blood just go through my body, and it just, like, my brain, like, opened up, and I was like, oh, my God, they're human. Like, they have feelings. Like, it just registered in my brain. And I just couldn't believe it. Like, he was throwing up because his brother passed away right there next to us. And that was my turning point. And I, you know, we had to continue to do what we were doing out there and, you know, just ride the time out.
And you were in for a total of 8 years. So what actually led you, because you are a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, I hope that's okay to say.
That's fine, yeah.
Because I just said it anyway. and so am I, and proud of it. So,
darn right.
So anyway, what actually led you to join Iraq Veterans Against the War? How did you?
That moment was the moment I made the decision that I'm against this war. I don't know why I'm here, and I want to do everything within my power to hopefully bring awareness to those situations that I'm sure so many have experienced. So as soon as I got back, I tried to go to the VA for, like, services, didn't really feel comfortable there. So then I kind of started going out more into the community. I met up with, I think it was, like, on Craigslist or something, and they did some sort of ad for, like, they wanted a woman veteran, and it was, like, for Nine Scripts of a Nation at War, a documentary. I think that base was, like, in England, and it ended up becoming an exhibit in the museum. But they're the ones that referred me to IVAW. I went to IVAW, and up until going to IVAW, like, they were doing a screening at Columbia University for Iraq for Sale. Up until that moment, I still hadn't really realized everything that I went through. I'm looking at Iraq for Sale. I mean, I guess the severity of it, how impactful it was, how it's changed our history. And when I seen Iraq for Sale, I just had a breakdown. And they kind of warned me about that, but I didn't really expect it. And that was, like, the first time that I really, like, had my breakdown. I cried, and IVAW was there. And I felt like that was the community that I felt comfortable with, where, you know, we could be ourselves.
And you've ended up being in, you've been featured in a book called The Lonely Soldier. Would you like to talk about what that book is?
Because
that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, briefly. So the author is a professor from Columbia University, and the book is, when we first did the book, I didn't know it was going to be totally based on MST, military sexual trauma. I thought the book was just going to be about, you know, a series of women, like maybe five different women and their stories and their experience in the military. But it ended up being totally based on military sexual trauma. And I have mixed feelings about that, but it's done really well. The book has done really well. And it actually inspired the Invisible War documentary.
Mm-hmm. I've yet to see that documentary. I don't think I can handle it.
Yeah,
Same.
Yeah, Iraq for Sale. Because last month we did a show on military sexual trauma that dealt with male-on-male sexual trauma. And that was really an eye-opener for a lot of people. I got a lot of calls about that, and because people just had no idea that that was going on. And in that book you're talking about, did they talk about that, male-on-male sexual trauma?
Yes, I think they mentioned it, but not as in depth as maybe they should have, like at least, because I think it was like about five women and they kind of broke it down to me. I haven't even been able to read the whole thing myself. And the book turned into a play, and it still airs on different colleges around the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Any trouble with sexual trauma while you were in the military?
Yeah, that's why, like I said, when we first started the book, I thought it was just going to be about different experiences from different eras for different women.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize then that military sexual trauma was such a prominent thing. I mean, I knew that every woman, to me, and this is my opinion, every woman has experienced some sort of sexual harassment, sexual assault to one degree or another, if you served in the military.
Yeah, it's true.
Minor or major, you know, I think every single woman has, and male too. But it was with the book where I realized that what I went through was actually really serious. So during the time that I was, I was still a supply clerk, you know, that month in Iraq, we had like a first sergeant that made us have formation every morning. I didn't believe in formation in country because, you know, if there was a attack to come, then it would hit everybody at once.
Right.
Yeah, so my form of protest in Iraq was I would show up to formation late all the time because I didn't believe in it. And I know the military is not a place for you to practice what you believe in or not. You just kind of have to do what you're supposed to do. But that was my little rebel inside. So from doing that, I got in trouble, quote unquote, and he made me do like extra duty. And like I said, we practice like control in Iraq, so you can't really just pitch black in most areas.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was left doing my extra duty, I had to walk back from our motor pool, I think it was called, back to our living area. So from that area, between there and there, the walk is like really dark, and we run off of generators. So generators are really loud. I always call like Iraq like the loudest silence I've ever heard. So when I was walking from there to here, there was like a sergeant who came and met up with me there, and he quote unquote was trying to like make sure I was safe walking back from there to there. And from that walk in the middle, he said, you know, if I was to rape you right now, no one would hear you. Like, what would you do? And he was right, because there was the generators and it was so dark. And I had my weapon on me, and I've never considered my weapon for another soldier ever. So I think I just kind of reverted back to sort of like the way I grew up or something. I don't know. And I just was like, I would stab you. And I didn't have a knife at the time, but I pretended like I did. And then we just kind of kept walking. So I feel like if I didn't say that, I don't know what would have happened. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he would say something like that. The next day I went and I got a knife from our little PX that we had there, and I would just practice with it every single day. And from now, and even to this day, I carry a knife with me all the time.
So did you feel a bigger threat from your fellow service men or from the Iraqi people?
They were different kinds of, like, I mean, with the, I don't like to paint all the people I served with, like the guys, as, you know, sexual predators, because they definitely weren't. But there were some that I would say, that guy definitely would felt more threatened, you know, where I felt like I could get raped or something like that from him, than I would ever feel from like an Iraqi soldier. But I also, they were two different types of threats that I felt.
Did you report that guy?
No.
Okay.
There was a girl. The reason why I didn't report her is because there was a woman who made a report early on when we first got to Iraq, and everyone knew about it, and she was sort of like blackballed for the whole deployment.
That happened on my boat as well. There was a girl that she was actually attacked, and she reported it, and we were all told to shun her, and everybody, I was the only person that would talk to her, actually, and so nobody talked to her. She was made to do the worst kind of work, the hardest, most laborious kind of work, and nobody would talk to her. And then a couple months later, her family got into a car accident, and two of her family members died in the accident, and the only surviving one was her deaf brother. And then all of a sudden, everybody tried to act like, "Oh, we're so sorry. Let's try to help you." And she ended up getting a
hardship
and hardship discharge. And I always wonder what happened to her, because she was treated really poorly. And I think pretty much every female in the military has experienced something. And I want to say that if you truly think you haven't, then you're probably just in some kind of Stockholm syndrome, walking dream state, that the military is something that's not, because it really is the most patriarchal, oppressive system on the planet. So,
yeah, that's anyway. Really a tough
one.
Yeah,
I completely agree.
Yeah. Did you, when you came back and got through with the military, did you go to the VA for any kind of counseling because of what happened to you?
No, I didn't realize what I had experienced was so, would have affected me to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So until that book, and when the book came out, it was an eye opener for me that I don't think I was ready for. But I'm glad that, you know, it's done well, and I think it's helped other women. But for me, it was just something that I wasn't really aware of. And to this day, it's not something I really want to like get into. I just like to have my knife with me, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, I understand that you have testified before the House of Representatives and the Senate about issues surrounding houseless veterans. Are you able to talk about that? What kind of thing that was, and why you've chosen that as something of importance in your life?
Yeah. So when I got back, I got pregnant with my daughter like within about a year after, and the reason why I joined the military was because I was looking for structure and a lot more stability, and I didn't really get that the way I had planned. So when I had my daughter, I saw myself, I admitted to myself that I was homeless, because I think like with a lot of women, it's easy for us to find a place to lay our head. So I had like places to lay my head, but I didn't really realize to myself, like, until one day I'm like, "You're homeless. Like, you don't have a place to live."
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think a lot of women go through that. I've talked to a lot of women that they say that they went through similar experiences. Mm-hmm. Where
I have definitely a couple times in my life as well, even with a job.
Yep. Yeah, because we have places that people will open their homes to us, and we'll have places to stay more than they would for a man.
But it's not stable housing.
Exactly. So, and especially like with your prides, a lot of times you just don't want it. Like, why would you want to admit to yourself like that you have nowhere to live? But I had my daughter, so I had no choice. And like, I just realized it one day, like, what is she going to do when she's going to kindergarten? Like, what school is she going to go to? So, so when I became homeless, I went to my work source center. I remembered previously checking a box that said, "Are you homeless?" And I said no, but I remember checking that box, and I went there, And I just got kind of lucky in the way that it worked out, where my the rep that they gave me was really, really good. She stayed till like about, she stayed late that day, just to make sure that Nyla and I got housing, my daughter. And there was a, she stayed late. She was calling around all these places. Everything was full. And if they weren't full, they didn't accept you with your, with a child. Yeah, but there, it was, it just so happened that one of the other employees there was actually a National Guard or reservist on the weekend also. So he called his commander, and his commander knew of a housing place in Long Beach. We called there, and they stayed late for us, for Nyla and I to drive over there, and I stayed in transitional housing for about a year. And I didn't tell my family. I really didn't tell anybody. I just, everybody kind of thought that I just got my own place out in Long Beach. So when I stayed there for a year, and then I got my VASH housing, but I, during all that time, I've always been really vocal. And that's when, I don't really remember how I was able to testify in front of Congress. I don't remember how that worked out, but that's why I was so willing to do it, because they were, I think they were looking to maybe cut funds or something for one of the housing programs. And I just kind of told my story about if, and the program was funded through the VA. So if the VA hadn't funded this program, I don't know where my daughter and I would have been.
Yeah, because I, you know, from what I've heard and talked to women veterans, is that there's a high, compared to the number of women that's been in the military, that there's a real high percentage of female veterans are homeless and also have drug and alcohol problems compared to the number of males that are homeless and with drug and alcohol problems, that women really take the brunt of that. And like you were saying, you couldn't find a place for you and your child to go to. That's really sad.
Right. And, you know, I was also, it's funny that you said drug and alcohol problem, because that was also like another problem I didn't really have at that time. But a lot of the places that were housing veterans sort of required you to have a drug or alcohol problem.
Really? What do you mean?
Yeah, like if their intake, if you call any housing, not any, majority of the housing places, their intake is going to ask you, like, did you have an alcohol or drug problem? And if you say no, they don't believe you. It's weird. It's so weird. Like, it's obviously a systematic problem. I mean, and yes, drug and alcohol is a big issue, but not every veteran has that issue. And
right.
Just because they don't have that issue doesn't mean they can't be homeless.
Right.
So I would always be looked at like I was lying when I would check no.
Did they, on your applications, when you were applying for places to stay through the VA, did they ask you if you had PTSD, post-traumatic stress?
I don't think it was specifically PTSD. I think it was more like mental health. You have any mental health issues?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I know that there's some places that that have had, like, caseworkers will kind of have their veterans check yes, just so that they can house them.
Wow.
Like, if you check yes, if you have a, yeah, drug or alcohol problem. And there was a time, there was a small time where I actually considered, like, doing a drug just so I could test hot, just so I could mark yes.
Wow.
Because they would always ask me that. And I feel like that, I mean, why do you have to start on such a negative note? I know that, I mean, you have to, it's a big problem, but just because a veteran marks no, they shouldn't be looked at like they're lying.
Right. Right, because probably, well, it is that the programs that are funded by the VA are, you know, basically that's why they were funded, because of drug and alcohol problems and mental health problems, and that's what they thought. Yeah, and that they thought that any veteran that was homeless has a mental problem or a drug and alcohol problem, which isn't true. It isn't true.
Right.
But that's how they got their funding.
Yeah, exactly.
Through that. So they always mark that. Do you get do you get your health care through the VA system?
Yes, I do.
That's great. That's great. Have you applied for a disability of any kind through the VA?
Now I have, yes.
great. That's good. That's good.
So what do you think people should know about Mika, how are we going to end the war?
Yeah. That's a simple one, Mika. Yeah, I mean, you know.
How are we going to end the illegal occupation? We have 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
How are we going to stop the drones?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm open to suggestions.
Yeah, what do you think people should know about veterans issues like today if we can reach people who may not know about these things? What do you think people should know about veterans and some of the issues that you've been working on in your life?
I would say one of the biggest things that I feel like has completely gone under the radar is the required financial assessment. Are you guys familiar with that?
No.
Nope.
So in order to, and as far as I understand, this is under Bush's administration. He required that all veterans are subject to a financial assessment in order to enroll into the VA, unless you've just returned from a theater of operation, then you have 5 years of, you can make as much money as you want. But so what this means is that if you were a veteran and let's say you served 18 years or 17, 15 years, not to where you can retire, mm-hmm. and you get out of the military and you get out of the military because you got a really good job, which is the best thing. You know, that's what we all want. We want veterans to come back and have a really good job. So they have their good job for about a year. Maybe they lose their job and now they're like, I don't have health care. All right, now I'm ready to go to the VA. So when they go to the VA, if they made more than $50,000 a year, and that's a rough estimate, it could be a little bit less, a little bit more, then they cannot enter the VA healthcare system unless they're service-connected. Mm-hmm. If they're not service-connected, they can't enroll in the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that needs to change. Why does it matter how much a veteran makes? Like, I feel like if you're a veteran, you should be able to go to VA anytime. The only people that are that can make as much as they want, like, you can make as much as you want after you're enrolled. If you're already enrolled, then you can make as much as you want. Mm-hmm. If you're service-connected, and I'm not sure about the percentages, then you can make as much as you want, and you can still enroll. And if you're a Vietnam-era veteran, you could make as much as you want at any time and enroll, because the VA recognized that a lot of Vietnam veterans didn't enroll in the VA healthcare system.
Yeah, what they did I'm a Vietnam vet, and what they did with a lot of Vietnam vets is that when they would apply for disability, because later in life the guys would file for disability, and what they would do, the government would do, would give them up to 70% or I think it was 80%. And then they wouldn't give them 100%. What they would do is make them unemployable. So they would say, well, you have 80% for your disabilities, but we're going to make you unemployable, so you'll get paid 100%. And when they did that to them, that made it so those guys couldn't make any money. They couldn't go out, you know, make money. But I think they've kind of lowered that a little bit, where that guys can now make up to a certain amount of money, but that's, they weren't wanting to give guys, you know, like 100%, and like with you folks, you know, they didn't want to give you folks PTSD. They wanted to give you other things, you know, and which I thought was very, very unfair to you folks. Is by not giving you, you know, a diagnosis of PTSD. I thought it was very unfair.
So you've done a little bit of work with the Vets Versus Hate campaign. I believe. Did you want to talk about what the #VetsVersusHate campaign is and what you think about that?
Yeah, so it's Vets Versus Hate is a movement. It's a hashtag Vets Versus Hate, and a lot of us have joined the Common Defense Pack. So the Common Defense Pack is a group of us veterans who got together who are trying to not get Trump elected. We can all consider it our moral obligation. And we aren't like for any other candidate. Like, we all disagree on who we think should be president, but one thing that we do agree on is that it shouldn't be Trump. So we recently partnered with moveon.org, and through them we created a petition to directed towards Senator McCain to disavow Donald Trump, because, you know, he's a well-respected veteran, and he's a man of honor. He's done a lot of great things in his military career and his political career. So we feel like if he was to disavow Trump, then maybe others would follow suit. So through moveon.org, we got over 100,000 signatures signing the petition to take to Senator McCain's office in less than 48 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
So it was pretty impressive. It was a rush. So we all went out to D.C. We all kind of spoke from our different point of views, and we're all over the nation. And we carried the signatures to his office, hoping that he would listen. And then just yesterday, they went to his office in Arizona. And you wouldn't believe this, but they didn't allow them in the office. They closed the doors to them, to veterans.
Wow.
Had the petition.
Mm-hmm. Did we get that on film?
Yeah, I think they got it on film. They got it on Facebook Live.
Because that doesn't look good when a politician walks away from a veteran.
A veteran, no. Especially politician.
A veteran constituent.
Yeah. A veteran politician closing the doors on veterans just doesn't seem quite right.
Right. Wow. I mean, a politician closing a door on any constituent is bad. But on a veteran constituent, that's absurd.
Wow.
It's really absurd.
Yeah, and I think the Vets versus Hate campaign is really about spreading a public awareness that veterans aren't the message is that vets are not props for hate. And yep. A lot of Trump's speech has been full of hate, and there are many, many progressive veterans. As a matter of fact, the military is breeding grounds for anti-war activists.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes,
and I think that's really what the campaign is about, is letting people know in a public way that because the right wing tries to depict veterans as being these pro-war advocates, and that's just really not the case. That's completely
right.
Untrue, and in fact completely opposite of, as we know from protests and things like that we've seen. But
yeah, I think
right.
You're right.
So it's like Vets versus Hate, like we're talking about how he kind of throws a blanket statement over all Muslims and calling them, you know, making them like they're all terrorists. And a lot of veterans, myself included, have stood up to defend, you know, our Muslim brothers and sisters, in saying that they aren't, like, this hate speech is harmful to our nation and to the world.
And how do you feel being a Latina veteran as well with
yeah
some of the things he's saying?
Oh man. There's so many reasons that I wanted to, that I don't want him elected, but he's insulted us in so many ways as a Latina, as veterans, as
women.
Yeah. Every single thing that I am, like every part of my identity, he's insulted, and he's getting away with it. And it's crazy that there's people who he's convincing, or they already were in that mindset, to agree. So part of me is like not even as mad as at Trump as I am at his supporters. Like he's one man that thinks this way, and he has so much support. It's insane.
Yeah.
Although his support is declining quite a bit.
Yeah. One of the things that really kind of made me really angry was when a veteran offered him his Purple Heart. Did you see that?
Yes.
I was really angry.
Can I ask one last thing before? What would you say to a young kid who is thinking about enlisting?
Wow, good one.
We talked about this. I do counter recruitment also here in LA. And you guys are, you know what counter recruitment is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
I've been doing it for 5 years, and it's fun.
So I do that too. Yeah, it's fun. and I don't. My intention isn't to steer anybody away from joining the military. Like for me, I don't regret my military service. I regret things that happened in it, but just to allow the teenagers to know what they're signing up for, and if they know what they're signing up for, then cool, all power to them. But the biggest eye opener I feel is, I tell like the students that I talk to, imagine a soldier, a sailor, a marine, coast guard, whatever. Like put that in your head, and we all can imagine that in our brains. We imagine this polished, standing tall, chin up, shoulders back.
White male.
Awesome looking person. White male, you know, hopefully that changes. But that's what we imagine, okay? So now, imagine a veteran. What do you envision? Is it the same vision? No, it's not.
Yeah.
And to me, that right there just proves how much the military does for you. Like, what, I don't know. So that's my thing, like, it sucks that our vision of a veteran is not the same as our vision of a service member.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it should not be that way.
That's a great point,
Mika. But the military recruitment completely focuses on the poorest kids, and also inner city youth, and so many rural kids, and it's disproportionately affects, it's the poverty draft. Since we have an all-volunteer military now, instead of kids with affluence going, it's mostly the poorest of the poor.
And it's a small percentage. A small percentage, right, of the population that's going in and doing it. Because when they send folks back to 4, 5, and 6 tours in a war zone, there's something bad wrong. Mika, right. We want to really thank you for coming on and talking about your experience in the military and the things you've done. And I've read your bio, and I really, really see some of the things that you've done, and you've really done a lot. And I know we know who you work for, and working through them, you can reach a lot of people and do a lot, right, of good work. And you are doing good work. And I personally want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for doing what you guys do.
Thank you, too.
It's so awesome.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye.
You too.
Bye.
And that was Mika Montoya. And she really talked about a lot of good things, and there's a lot more to go. And one of the things that really interests me was her being treated like a second-class citizen. And we'll be back Friday, September 16th at 9 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM. And there it is.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.